Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Conquering Spirit, Fort Mims and the Red Stick War of 1813 to 1814, by Gregory A. Wasilkoff, narrated by Stephen Caffrey. Introduction. September 11, 2001. December 7, 1941. Remember the Lusitania. Remember the Maine. Remember the Alamo. Every generation of Americans, it seems, has collectively experienced an event of such palpable violence and manifest injustice that the very mention rallies the nation to a common purpose, a bloody-minded determination to destroy this new enemy and avenge the fallen. With the passage of years, however, earlier national traumas fade in emotional impact, each in turn replaced in the country's consciousness by more immediate, more horrific insults. Historical perspective can also lead to reevaluations of events thought patently evil at the time. The explosion that sank the U.S. battleship Maine in Havana Harbor, directly precipitating an American declaration of war against Spain in 1898, may have been due to a shipboard accident rather than a bomb planted by either Cuban provocateurs or Spanish agents as originally supposed. The civilian cruise liner RMS Lusitania, torpedoed by a German U-boat while bound for England with numerous neutral American passengers in 1915, an event that contributed to America's eventual entry into World War I, may have carried contraband munitions, British denials at the time notwithstanding. And historians argue endlessly over the reasons some 200 Texan revolutionaries chose to defend the Alamo to the death in 1836 rather than withdraw in the face of Santa Anna's overwhelming Mexican force. These epical moments invite continuing intellectual scrutiny for their influence on the course of American history. Why and how did they pull us collectively in new national directions, ending in the acquisition of an overseas colonial empire, involvement in a European war, and American expansion at the expense of Mexico, still a contentious issue for our neighbors to the south? But of course, they appeal at another level. They kindle the imagination and excite emotions as tales of intense human interest. The battle at Fort Mims was one such turning point in American history. At noon on August 30, 1813, a fiercely fought battle occurred on the southern frontier of the United States, at the fortified plantation home of Samuel Mims in the Tensaw District of Mississippi Territory in modern-day Alabama. Amidst the War of 1812, America's second struggle against Great Britain, a large segment of the Creek Indian Nation, the Red Sticks, rose up to defend their lands and their traditional culture from U.S. encroachment and domination. The battle at Fort Mims is best known in that context as a stunningly bloody Indian victory, but just one in a very long series of armed conflicts between American Indians and whites spanning four centuries. If that is the extent of our understanding of Fort Mims, then we do not grasp why the event came about or how it influenced the course of United States history in many important ways. One task here is to look closely at the battle, to cut through the leg ends and misinformation that have grown around this event almost from the moment the last embers died at the smoldering ruins of Fort Mims. At least as important as the details of battle, though, are the remarkable convergence of social forces that sparked that conflict and the repercussions of the battle, which echo still nearly 200 years later. The extreme violence that erupted at Fort Mims on that late summer day in 1813, the horror of 250 or more soldiers and refugees, men, women, and children, immolated in buildings set ablaze by the Red Sticks, has long claimed the nation's attention for a permanent place in our collective historical memory. But memory registers more than emotional shock and anguish. Events such as this have great moment because people's thoughts and behaviors change in response. The prevailing attitude of white Americans toward Indians shifted significantly in the aftermath of the battle, away from the government's policy of cultural assimilation and toward a new style of American colonialism. We are not yet accustomed to that notion, despite a generation of consciousness raising by American Indians and others in the popular media and scholarly literature. The expansion of the United States involved not just the purchase of vast land tracts from European and Mexican claimants, but the imposition of American colonial rule on the indigenous Indian nations that occupied and actually owned those lands. A study of this battle and the ensuing Red Stick War offers an opportunity to explore, from that still novel perspective, a stunning failure in American colonial policy toward the Creek Indians, well-meaning though its intentions surely were. This well-documented battle also permits a close examination of the Creeks themselves, a numerous and ethnically complex people who inhabited a large portion of the American Southeast at the turn of the 19th century. Historians are currently engaged in an important debate on the rise of the concept of race in Indian societies of that era, and the Red Stick War figures prominently in that ongoing dialogue. The open gate at Fort Mims beckons us to confront these and other neglected facets of our common past. This book's title, A Conquering Spirit, derives from correspondence written on September 30, 1813, precisely 1 month after the engagement at Fort Mims, by Benjamin Hawkins, since 1796, the federal government's principal agent for Indian affairs south of the Ohio. Hawkins invoked Indian imagery, recalling the ferocity of Gulf Coast hurricanes, both surprising, before our era of satellite imagery, and devastating in their impact. To General John Floyd of the Georgia State Militia, he wrote, "The Master of Breath, supreme deity of the Creek Indians, has permitted a conquering spirit to arise among them like a storm, and it shall ravage like a storm." Hawkins alluded to Red Stick warriors exhilarated by their success at Fort Mims. But a conquering spirit reveals equally well the psyche of General Andrew Jackson and other white Americans who saw in the tragedy of Fort Mims at once a national disaster and an opportunity to seize vast expanses of Indian lands by conquest. Thousands in Tennessee, the Carolinas, Georgia, and Mississippi Territory volunteered, in Jackson's words, to carry a campaign into the heart of the Creek Nation and exterminate them. Yet another conquering spirit arose in the battle's aftermath. As we shall see, the conflict that erupted at Fort Mims resulted from the colliding interests of four peoples: settlers of European descent, the Native American Creeks, African Americans, held in slavery by both whites and Indians, and the mixed-race offspring of the other three. Some 30 years earlier, former British loyalists had sought a haven at this southern limit of the Creek Nation following the loss of their homes in the Carolinas, Georgia, and Florida during the American Revolution. In ensuing years, a few Creek Indians, nearly all of mixed European Indian descent, settled nearby, where they might freely embrace the plantation economy of their white neighbors, far from the social controls of traditional Creek culture. Ultimately, rejection of American pressures by a large segment of the Creek people to assimilate and cede their lands to the expanding United States took violent form. In a 5-hour battle between at least 700 Red Stick warriors and a besieged garrison of 100 militiamen from Mississippi Territory and the 300 white, Creek, and African civilians they were sent to protect. In its final stages, the fight at Fort Mims degenerated into a massacre of civilians by Red Sticks. In the ashes of Fort Mims, we can read the failure of these groups to coexist. As they sought new ways forward in the wake of war's destructive fury, we can also appreciate the resilient spirits of these diverse peoples. Creek Indians in a Changing Colonial World. The 2 decades preceding the battle at Fort Mims brought radical upheaval to the lives of Creek Indians. In the span of a single generation, a populous, expansion-minded United States colonized the Creek country more intrusively and completely than the French, British, and Spaniards had ever imagined doing in the previous 2 centuries. To understand the traumatic events of 1813, one must grasp the nature of Creek culture and society in earlier days, and the wrenching changes forced upon the Creeks by their powerful neighbor. Fortunately, we can draw on a century of fine scholarship to outline and interpret this complex subject in brief. By the end of the American Revolutionary War in 1783, the diverse peoples that composed the Creek Nation had been in contact with Europeans for 2.5 centuries. The first foray by Spaniards into the heart of the Southeast was Hernando de Soto's Entrada of 1539. In the wake of that failed attempt at conquest, Spain established modest settlements and missions in Florida that maintained sporadic interaction with the native peoples of the interior Southeast throughout the late 16th and 17th centuries. These intermittent contacts introduced several Old World organisms into the region, most notably some disease pathogens that devastated previously unexposed Indian populations, along with benign cultigens like the peach and black-eyed pea. As interior Southeasterners became familiar with the technologies and desires of the Spaniards to their south, a small-scale trade developed between the two peoples. Common forest products like deerskins, sassafras bark, and bezoar stones excited great interest among the Europeans, who willingly gave glass beads, brass ornaments, and iron tools in exchange. Each side thought they had the better of the deal, and each imbued the other's goods with mystical, even sacred powers. For their part, Europeans hoped sassafras would cure syphilis, and paranoid nobles deployed bezoar stones, spheroidal concretions, gastric pearls found in deer intestines, as antidotes to poisons. Southeastern Indians, on the other hand, imagine copper and brass to be sacred materials, long associated with the ruling elites of prehistoric chiefdoms. While the Indians welcomed easy access to hitherto scarce commodities, these imported objects did not immediately replace native counterparts. European ornaments and tools were integrated slowly into native technologies, on native terms, and with considerable deliberation, in ways that seemed most beneficial to the southeastern Indians. Far to the north, however, the Dutch and the English began trading firearms to the Iroquois and a few other native groups. Unequal access to those weapons sparked a seemingly endless series of wars between Indian peoples, wars that set into motion long-distance relocations of populations armed only with stone-tipped arrows, desperate to escape the onslaughts of warriors with guns. Disease and warfare reworked the population map of the Southeast. By the late 17th century, new tribal societies had formed from the dispersed remnants of late prehistoric chiefdoms that once occupied the region during Soto's time. The Creek people emerged from this demographic chaos of the 17th century. A century earlier, peoples speaking the Muscogee language are thought to have occupied two clusters of towns in the future Creek heartland. One group lined the banks of the lower Tallapoosa River in modern-day central Alabama, northeast of Montgomery, with a second along the central Chattahoochee River, the present Alabama-Georgia border, south from the vicinity of Columbus, Georgia. These core areas of stable settlement attracted refugees as surrounding peoples suffered epidemics and slave raids. Many of the newcomers, such as Abecas and Hechites from northern Georgia, Coasatis from eastern Tennessee, and Alabamas from eastern Mississippi and southern Alabama, spoke related Muscogean languages. Others, like the Yuchis, Tawassas, and elements of the Shawnees, came from greater distances and spoke unrelated languages. Entire towns of refugees were apparently welcomed if they respected the customs of the original towns and agreed to forego warfare with other disparate members of this union of convenience. By 1700, dozens of independent towns had become loosely allied in four geographical clusters: Abecas on the Coosa and Upper Tallapoosa Rivers, Alabama towns on the Upper Alabama River, Tallapoosas on the Lower Tallapoosa River, and Coweta's on the central Chattahoochee. The British gradually came to refer to all of these peoples, collectively, as Creeks, a name derived from a group of Muscogees living in Georgia along Ochees Creek, whom the British called Ochees Creeks, or Creeks for short. The Coweta's became known as Lower Creeks, and others as Upper Creeks. Upper, because the towns were farther up the trading path from Charleston. However, the British term creeks, or even more specific, upper creeks and lower creeks, suggested political and social unities that barely existed in the early 18th century. Individuals self-identified first with a family, their mother's lineage and clan, then with a town, and finally with a regional division of towns: Tallapoosas, Alabamas, etc. A sense of common identity as Creeks developed very slowly in the course of the 18th century. Even today, among Creeks and Seminoles in Oklahoma, individuals often think of their relationships to others primarily in terms of town affiliation. With those disclaimers in mind, for the sake of simplified discussion, I use the term Creeks when referring to all the native peoples of central Alabama and Georgia, without necessarily implying any particular degree of political cohesion. Creek families of the 18th century were matrilineal. Such families differ in many ways from the bilineal families of modern America, in which we consider ourselves equally related to our father's family and our mother's family. Among the Creeks, a couple's children belong to the mother's extended family or lineage, but not the father's. Perhaps most foreign to our way of thinking, a biological father had little to do with raising his sons, a responsibility that fell to the mother's brothers, and any of his property left as inheritance would have gone to his sister and her children, members of his matrilineage, not to his own children. This matrilineal system of kinship was common among the farming peoples of southeastern North America and may have arisen as families invested immense labor in clearing and maintaining agricultural fields. Nearly all farming tasks, planting, weeding, and harvesting, fell to women in the late prehistoric Southeast. Agricultural clearings were hard won from the forest with stone axes, and the judicious application of fire, and strenuously maintained year after year with stone or shell hoes. A matrilineal system of descent and inheritance kept fields under the control of related cooperating women and their children. A clan consisted of matrilineages related to each other through a common ancestor, represented by a mythical clan spirit or totem. Centuries earlier, each society probably just had a few clans, but adoption of so many refugee groups by the historic Creeks resulted in their proliferation. In fact, clans were so numerous that they too, like Creek towns, were organized into larger groups, the Hatakake, or white clans, specifically the Beaver, Bear, Bird, and Wind clans, and the Chilokakake, literally speakers of different language, comprising all other clans. This division may reflect the separate origins of the core Muscogee groups and later immigrants. Clans served many purposes in Creek social life. Most importantly, they were exogamous. A person could not marry another from the same clan. Such a pairing would have been incestuous, a marriage between relatives. Children, of course, belonged to their mother's clan, not their father's. Because each clan's members were dispersed throughout Creek society, since men moved away from their mothers' homes to take up residence with wives of different clans, a native traveler could usually find a clan relative, no matter how far from home, even when visiting other societies like the Choctaws and Cherokees. Clan leaders organized the major social events of the year, such as the annual Posquita, or fast, known to whites as the Busk or Green Corn Ceremony, and other periodic dances and feasts. The eldest members of a clan passed judgment and meted out punishment to wrongdoers within the clan, a practice that controlled inter-clan conflicts and limited otherwise endless cycles of blood revenge. Birth into particular clans also determined to some extent the roles and options one could aspire to in life. For instance, women of the Wind clan were shown great respect, with even the youngest called grandmother by all other Creeks. A man of the Wind clan could ascend to the second tier of authority, to the roles of Heniha, or counselor, and este kakukake, or beloved man, but seldom, if ever, became miko, or head man. On the other hand, men of the bear clan achieved the status of miko more often than others. Unfortunately, we know little about the histories and internal functionings of the clans, but they clearly imposed a structure and order on Creek social life and integrated a dispersed population. Each Creek family was affiliated with a Itawa, usually translated as town. A Itawa comprised the people of a community distinguished from its physical place and buildings, which were known collectively as a talofa. Most Itawas had populations of a few hundred, but more important than size was social and political coherence and independence, represented by several public structures. The chokorako, or square ground, consisted of four open-fronted buildings facing a plaza. The chukofa, rotunda, or council house, an enclosed circular or multi-sided building, and the chunky yard, or bowl yard, where games were played. A town's leading men met regularly at the square ground in the warm season, or the rotunda in winter, to discuss and reach consensus on important issues. For any number of reasons, a portion of a Itawa might decide to break away from the rest. Such a splinter group could either create a new, separate Itawa, a daughter town to the original mother town, or establish an outlying talofa, a smaller residential center lacking public structures and still associated with and subordinate to the original Itawa. In the late 18th century, as Creek residences became increasingly dispersed, widely separated Itawa members maintained ties by attending town social events at public buildings and game yards that frequently stood alone, no longer surrounded by residences. This drift of residences away from the Itawa square grounds coincided with changes in farming methods. Creek agriculture inherited much from the prehistoric Mississippian farmers of the Southeast, who had developed corn, maize, into a staple crop hundreds of years earlier. They discovered that fields cleared alongside major streams and rivers could be planted year after year, because the silt deposited on riverbank levees by annual spring floods replenished nutrients drawn out of the soil by the corn plants. Prehistoric southeastern farmers also knew to interplant beans among the corn. Those clingy legumes would climb the corn stalks while their underground rhizomes fixed nitrogen in the soil. Many other plants, some domesticated, like sunflowers, others wild, like hickory nuts, supplemented the major crops. Apart from the dog, early Southeasterners lacked domesticated animals, so hunting remained important until the 19th century. White-tailed deer provided the bulk of consumed meat, followed distantly by other mammals and wild turkeys. That said, a simple itemization of species critical to Creek subsistence does not convey an accurate sense of Creek interconnectedness with the environment. Animals, plants, places, earth, water, fire. To the Creek people of the 18th century, all were manifestations of spirits. Principal among them was Hesa Ketamase, literally, breath holder, commonly translated as master of breath, and represented on earth by the sacred fire, among other forms. The master of breath gave the Creeks the black drink. One can make a pleasant-tasting caffeine.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?